This is NHL Radio.
Time now for NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Home Ice.
And good afternoon, everybody. It is the NHL Hour. I am not Commissioner Gary Bettman. I am Billy Jaffe coming to you from atop the NHL store powered by Reebok here in Midtown Manhattan. The Commissioner will be with us in just a few minutes. For now, though, let me remind you that the number to call into the show, 1-877-645-6696, 1-877-645-6696. We'll get to your calls shortly, and later we're going to be joined, the Commissioner and I will be joined by the new general manager of the Dallas Stars and a fellow Big Red, that's right, a fellow alum, or I guess it would be alumnus of Cornell, that would be Joe Neuwendijk. And so as we bring you this open, the Commissioner, needless to say, a busy man, is on his way in right now. In fact, I guess he's running up the stairs right now. He will be here joining me in just about, I'm going to say 12 seconds or so right now. So we got you through the open, and we're going to remind you again, it's 1-877-645-6696. The number to call, I was wrong, I said 12 seconds, it was 11 seconds. The Commissioner hath arrived.
Elvis is in the house. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you for covering me.
My pleasure. It's a, you know what, we'll thank Baldy over here. He says, let's make sure we have somebody. It worked out well.
Well, actually, thank you to both of you for your good planning, and I apologize for being late. I'm getting a little sloppier as the season winds down.
Busier or sloppier?
Well, you know, beauty's in the eyes of the beholder. Actually, from here, obviously, I am leaving very quickly to go to Pittsburgh for tonight's game, and I realized on the way down in the elevator, which would have had me on time, that I forgot something. But that's just a function of running around too much. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. A good day in Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan for me. Always a pleasure to do the NHL live show and then to get a stick around to do this. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you for doing that, and it's good to see you. And I know Mr. Clement will be grateful as well that you were able to fill in for him. So what's new in our world?
What's new in our world? Well, a lot. Not just the game four of the Stanley Cup tonight.
First lot. Three games have been good.
Better than good.
Better than good. Ratings in the United States have been really, for us, off the charts in terms of the strength that we're showing.
What you expected number-wise, or meaning you could feel this, could see this?
Well, part of it had to do, and I know we got a little bit of criticism for this, but part of it had to do with the way we scheduled. We didn't, you know, there was a lot of speculation as to why we did what we did, but it was intended to give people an opportunity to really focus on the fact that the final was starting and to really let it build quickly. And the numbers on NBC for the first two games were spectacular, up dramatically. And the back-to-back concept, which is what we thought would lead to that, bore itself out. And Versus had its highest-rated program, yep. Not just highest-rated NHL game, highest-rated program in the history of the network on Tuesday night. And I believe they were the most viewed cable network in the United States.
Yep.
Those are good signs. These are the types of, you know, of data points. This was the type of reaction that we were hoping for, particularly with Versus, when we decided four seasons ago to go with them and to build together. And it seems to be working that way. You know, other things that have gone on, you probably discussed it on your show. Canadiens announced a new coach, Jacques Martin, and good luck to them and to him. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly enough, the media reaction has been a little mixed.
Well, but it's Montreal, so there's obviously a ton of media and a ton of scrutiny, and there's thinking outside the box, and then there was somewhat coming out of left field, and I think this caught a lot of people like out of left field.
Well, you know, sometimes what happens is, and I think you make a good point. I mean, he's a great hockey guy and a great hockey mind and a terrific coach. So, you know, I think sometimes in anything, not just in sports, not just in hockey, politics as well, when the media gets caught by surprise, they tend to react by having a negative reaction. because maybe, you know, they feel that they shouldn't have been caught by surprise.
Yeah, like, where did this come from, and
exactly.
How didn't I think about
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
But it is a different, you know, Commissioner, it was a very different take on what the people thought would happen in Montreal.
Well, but the conventional wisdom, and you know, I see this a lot in some of the decisions we make. The conventional, in quote, wisdom isn't always the fully informed wisdom or even what's best for long-term judgments. Dallas Stars named Joe Noondijk as general manager, and he's actually going to visit later in the program.
Mm-hmm. A fellow Cornell. It's not a Cornellian, but I know.
No,
I know
it is
that.
A Cornellian.
It is a Cornellian?
Yes, that's what they call them in us, Cornellians.
Okay.
You know, whatever Cornelian is, I mean, you know, I know what it is, but it's kind of a strange
a
word.
Fellow Big Redder.
Yes, fellow Big Redder. I don't think I hear that too often, uh-huh. but Cornelian. Colorado Avalanche named Greg Sherman general manager yesterday, and I believe they just
yes, they did.
Joe Sacco is new coach, 40 years old.
Yeah, another one of these coaches, Commissioner, coming up from the American League, bringing a new age, a new era, a new style, the new NHL, seeing this become the norm instead of the unconventional wisdom that we were just talking about. Remember, a few years ago, it was always the old guard.
I think the conventional wisdom or the unconventional wisdom has become the conventional wisdom. And these things go through cycles.
Sure.
But it's good to see. So welcome and good luck to them. Calgary's looking for a coach. The Florida Panthers are looking for a general manager. And obviously, in the last couple of weeks, Edmonton made a coaching change, and Pat Quinn and Tom Rennie were named, and in Minnesota, Chuck Fletcher, general manager. A lot of pieces moving around. You know, one of the things that's interesting.
And looking for a coach there too.
Yes.
Yeah.
The very good point. A lot of the media in the course of the last week, when I've been in Detroit and in Pittsburgh. Say, well, you know, how does the league feel about clubs making all these announcements and all these moves during the final? And, you know, it's a distraction. And I scratch my head and I say, you know, you got 28 clubs who aren't where they right. wanted to be. There's a draft coming up. There's free agency coming up. You've got a season that's already being planned for in next season. And, you know, the other clubs don't have the luxury of taking the 2 weeks off. And I don't blame them for wanting to do business and get attention.
And think about the plethora of media, hockey media, all in one place right now, whether it's Pittsburgh Ooh. Or Detroit. I didn't go to Cornell, but once in a while I have a decent word that comes out like that.
No. I was thinking of all that media in one place.
Oh, okay.
It makes me nervous.
But on the other hand, think about now. Maybe that media, let's say you have a reporter from this city or that city that, you know, is just covering the cup final. Now they're going to mention this other move as well. In other hockey news, this has happened as well in Florida, in Minnesota, in here, in there. So it actually helps create perhaps more notice of what that move is in a non-Stanley Cup contending team town.
Well, and also we had a meeting of the general managers on Tuesday in Pittsburgh yep. and then a joint meeting for the first time of the general managers and club presidents just to begin a dialogue on issues that overlap between the hockey side and the business side. And there was a lot of attention given to the representatives of all the clubs that were there. So, you know, I think this time of year the attention is and should be primarily focused on what's going on the ice in the final, but it's not the only thing that's going on. And quite frankly, it can't be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we don't mind you know, if somebody was holding a press conference to make an announcement in an hour, you know, on just as
sure.
about a game's begin, but nobody does that.
That's a real quick question about the general manager meetings. Just can you take us inside and tell us what a meeting like that, it's a one-day meeting, only this one. I know you have yeah. longer meetings throughout the year, but is it intense? Are they is it across the board intense, relaxed, joking, or jovial? What's it like when you get these 30 powerful guys together in a room like that?
It's all of the above. That you know, in a 3.5 or 4 hour meeting, particularly at this time of year, there's a lot of informational things that are discussed, where things are being passed on, procedures for the draft. You know, a lot of mundane things, informationally, you have to know how to make trades at the draft, things like that. But when it comes to actually focusing on the game and how it's being played, That's something the managers take extremely seriously. They are, in the first and probably final analysis, the day-to-day custodians of the game and how it's being played and what the rules are. And those discussions can be very intense, and they can also be very emotional.
Headshot issue intense and emotional?
Well, we've been discussing the headshot issue on a regular basis, so it wasn't something new. But the other point before I answer that question I'll make is Coley Campbell and I, around the time of the meeting, started focusing on the people in that room, a lot of former players. And there was something like 200 years of NHL playing experience in that room. So in terms of their touch and feel of the game, it was another opportunity to discuss the headshot issue. It was discussed in over the years in great detail. 2 years ago, we issued very clear standards and guidelines, put out a DVD so that players would understand that if you target the head, if you hit a player when he's vulnerable, if it's a late hit, and we went through the list of criteria, and that resulted in a number of double-digit suspensions in the start of 2 seasons ago and has continued on. At this point, you know, in light of the fact that the Players Association, at least Paul Kelly, has been suggesting a two-minute penalty when a shoulder hits the head, the managers as a group, and I saw it reported somewhere that the managers decided they don't care about hits to the head. That's not true at all. They're very concerned about it, but having a penalty called like the OHL does, the sense was it will be too erratic that late in the game there'll be a good, clean, legal hit, but it'll be a big head or a player will snap his head back, and bam, you're going to have a penalty at the wrong time on what is clearly a legal hit, and the result would be inconsistencies and discouraging body checking. Mm-hmm. The better view, at least according to the managers, is, listen, this is the type of play when it arises that's better done by supplemental discipline. They express great confidence in the way that Coley Campbell has been handling this, that when you have the luxury of videotape, you can discern intent, you can really slow it down and look at what happened, because a lot of people, you know, believe that the Cronwall hit on Havlat was a legal hit, and the result of that was a five-minute major in a game. And frankly, you know, based on the rules and the type of hitting that goes on in the game that's legal, and if you're going to take that type of hit out of the game, then you're going to dramatically be reducing hitting. And Coley spent a lot of time with Mike Murphy and the hockey operations guys looking at this. You know, in the course of a season, you may see half a dozen hits that you really don't like. But, you know, there are probably somewhere around 40 or 45,000 hits in the course of a season, and most of them are good, clean hits. But having said that, we think it needs to be punished, but we believe the best way to do it is through the supplemental discipline process. Frankly, you know, knowing you're getting suspended is much more of a deterrent than a two-minute penalty, and to call the two-minute penalty in the ways that and the problems that you would have with doing it, we think would simply discourage hitting in the game, and we're not looking to reduce the physicality. So on that note, we'll go take some calls. Before I do that, I'll remind people that tonight's game is on at 8 o'clock. It's on the CBC. It's on Versus. And we're looking forward to an exciting game 4. And on that note, why don't we go to Phil in Michigan? You're on with Billy and Gary.
I've got a couple things here, but the one thing that bothers me more than anything is the inconsistency in the officiating. And you mentioned the Cromwell hit. What about the Brown hit? That was, you know, same type of hit. Well, to a point, it was the same type of hit, questionable. And then you got the Malkin and the instigator. You've got the spear that was at the end of the game on Osgood in Game 3. And we talk about the interference, or what we always called obstruction, when you get in the guy's way coming into the zone after he dumps the puck in. That goes all game, but then we decide the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game, hey, let's call that penalty on a weak call on Erickson. And yes, I am biased because I'm a Detroit fan.
Yes.
But, you know, and then and I'm timing it tonight. It just takes the time that Osgood covers up to the time he gets the whistle versus when Corey covers up the time he'll get a whistle.
You know,
it's a quick call.
By the way, okay, I got the point. And you know, The great thing about the game is the passion our fans have, and if you're rooting for Detroit, there are calls that have happened through the playoffs that you're not going to like, and if you're a Penguins fan, there are calls that have been made or not made that you're not going to like. But at the end of the day, what people need to take into account is that these officials don't have the benefit of seeing it in slow-mo after it happens. They're on the ice. They've got a split second to make the call, and they're getting it right, you know, 98-99% of the time. Doesn't mean that they're perfect, because they are occasionally missing calls or making the wrong calls, but overwhelmingly. The one point I really want to address, though, is the rescission of the Malkin instigator in the last 5 minutes. That's actually something we raised with the managers just to make sure we were getting it right as a group. That penalty was intended to prevent incidents, you know, to send a message at the end of a game that was out of reach. It was not intended to simply be addressed to a fight at the spur of the moment, you know, in the heat of the moment. And in fact, the rule itself contemplates the rescission under appropriate circumstances of the automatic suspension. So Coley Campbell was being perfectly consistent with the intention of the rule. And, you know, I asked the managers about that in the group, and universally they all agreed that the right thing was done in that case.
And I believe we saw the similar scenario in the Anaheim-Detroit series, the end of, was it game six in Anaheim? There was a scrap, and the whistle blew in it, and there was a rescission there,
yeah.
And so I think we've seen it a few times. That I know.
Absolutely. Let's go to Garrett in Pittsburgh. So we'll balance off the Michigan rooting interest with the Western Pennsylvania rooting interest. Garrett, you're on with Billy and Gary.
How are you guys doing?
We're good. How are you?
Good, Mr. Commissioner. Hey, I wanted to talk about the referees, and I thought that they've done a phenomenal job. Throughout the entire playoffs, every Penguins series, you know, they've missed a couple, but they've called the ones that they have needed to call. And I feel like in games 1, 2, 3, and 4 in the Cup so far, they're letting them play, and they're letting these skilled players play and determine these hockey games.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I think, and particularly our last caller, it seems to be under the impression that the officials get a different set of instructions for the playoffs. They don't. But, you know, the game moves very fast. What I always do at a game, and, you know, and I confess that sometimes when I'm sitting at a game and you know, sometimes I'm looking at different things and probably viewing it a little different than a fan might in a particular case. When a call's made, the first thing I'm looking at is, where was the official standing? And if the official was in position and got a good view, you know what? He's probably right. That's why sometimes I chuckle, you know, when an arena goes nuts over an offside call, you know, when the guy in the building who had the best possible view was standing on the blue line, knew exactly what happened. Doesn't mean they sometimes don't blow a call, but for the most part, they get it pretty right.
Well, you end up having that too many men on the ice call, Gary, wasn't there. And as from your perspective, were you just like a normal fan saying, whoa, there's six guys out there?
My first reaction is, thank God nobody scored a goal.
Okay,
you know.
That's not a typical fan.
You know, as Coley Campbell likes to say, there are some times when the arm goes up, we'd like to reach through the TV and rip it down. But you know, it sometimes happens. But overwhelmingly, particularly, we've got our best officials on the ice now down the home stretch. But listen, you know, players make mistakes on the ice, and goals get scored. You know, coaches make mistakes, and it's a game with a human element to it, and that's part of the excitement. However, and as I always say, and it's true, we hold the officials accountable, and, you know, you make a lot of mistakes. You're not working as long into the season or as long into a career. We want as few mistakes as possible, but they're going to happen. Let's go to Norm on Long Island. You're on with Billy and Gary.
Good afternoon, Mr. Commissioner. Billy, love your work with Howie.
Thanks, buddy.
I'm calling as an Islander fan. I know Mr. Wong is going on one of the local radio stations today to talk about the lighthouse, and I was wondering if you had any more information with that. And, Billy, this is directed at you, Matt Duchene or John Tavares. I'll hang up. Keep up the good work, guys.
What about Hedman?
I said on the show earlier today, I didn't eliminate Victor, in my opinion, but I think they're going to go with an offensive player. That's out of I think they're going to go with Tavares, John Tavares, or Matt Duchene. And he's going to ask me which one, and I honestly don't get to see these guys play. I'm so, you know, involved in the NHL game. I'm just going off of scouting reports and mythology almost on these kids. You know what I mean? So I'm going to give you a bad answer either.
That's no answer.
Like I said, a bad answer.
With respect to the Islanders, Charles Wong has been incredible owning that club. I know the fans have wished that the club would have more success on the ice, and they will. They obviously have the number one pick this year. But in terms of his support of this franchise, financially, emotionally, his support of Long Island, nobody could have done and is doing more. He needs the approvals from the town of Hempstead and Nassau County so the Lighthouse Project can move forward. And obviously, this is a team that is in dire need of a new arena. There's no question about it. And at some point, the lease will be over, and the team won't have to play in that building. And I sure hope there's an alternative for them to play in, because I have no expectation that they'll stay in that building 1 minute longer than they have to. And you know what? They shouldn't. Because, you know, there's got to be a new building arrangement. It just simply has to be.
Amen. That's all I can say to that.
On that note, callers, please stay on hold. We will get to your calls as soon as we can. But when we come back, we'll be joined by the new general manager of the Dallas Stars, Cornell alum Joe Neuwendijk. And it's all coming up next on the NHL Hour. Lost track of how far I've gone, how far I've gone, how high I've climbed, on the backs of 60-pound stones.
Hi, this is Dion Phaneuf of the Calgary Flames, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Welcome back to the NHL Hour. Gary Bettman here with Billy Jaffe in our New York studios. We will get back to your calls soon, but first we have a special guest on the line. Joe Neuwendijk, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the show, and it's an even bigger pleasure for me because we actually went to the same school, although at different times, because I'm much older than you are. For our listeners who have been asleep for the last 25 years, Joe is a three-time Stanley Cup champion, each title coming with a different team, the Flames in 89, the Stars in 99, and the Devils in 2003. And he was a Conn Smythe winner with the Stars in 99. Joe played 20 seasons, scoring 1,126 points in 1,257 games. And since your retirement in December of 06, you've been a special assistant to then Florida General Manager Jacques Martin, and later in Toronto as an assistant GM to Cliff Fletcher, who drafted you for Calgary in 85 and for Brian Burke. So you have a pretty compelling resume. This has been quite a week for you. You want to tell us what it's been like?
Well, it has been quite a week. You know, leading up to the press conference here in Dallas, I left that morning, had the press conference in Dallas, and turned around quickly and got on a plane and met all you good people in Pittsburgh on Tuesday morning. So nothing like getting right into the fire as far as GM meetings go. But it's been a crazy few days, but one that I'm really excited about.
What was it like for you being introduced to the other general managers as the Dallas general manager? And was the general manager's meeting, although this was an abbreviated one, anything like what you had envisioned?
To be honest with you, I didn't know really what to expect. It didn't surprise me at all that my former boss, Brian Burke, kind of carried the show at times. So that that was, you know, I expected that. But for me, it was kind of ironic, too, that I thought I'd be the low man on the totem pole there. But, geez, since I, you know, here we go with Colorado, and then at my press conference, Jacques Martin was announced at the same time going to Montreal. So I think I was 28 or 29 on the depth chart in a matter of a few hours. So, but it was good to get there, Gary. It was good to meet all those other guys. And, you know, there's a lot of guys around my age, like Chuck Fletcher and Ray Shiro. And so it was just good to meet them all.
You're one of what I'll call the new generation of general managers, but you've played for a number of general managers. You played for Lamoriello, Gainey, Martin, Burke, Fletcher either worked with or played for them. What's your sense of who is your role model and why in terms of the way you think you should be conducting yourself?
Well, I'm first and foremost the man who drafted me way back in 1985, as you mentioned, Cliff Fletcher. I have nothing but the utmost respect for. I think he's a caring individual who treats everybody the same, and I've tried to, you know, carry myself that way over the course of my career too. I've been very fortunate with some of the names you mentioned to be a part of, Lou Lamoriello and Bob Gainey, real classy individuals who have had a lot of success in this business. You know, I have a lot of respect for Lou Lamoriello, the way he runs things in New Jersey, and I think the way the success of their franchise speaks for itself. So I've been very fortunate to be around a lot of good people that try and take a little piece from everybody.
There's always this custom or practice where the older, more senior general managers act in a predatory way to the new general managers. Anybody call you yet and try and pick your pocket?
Well, not really, but Brian Murray did say to me, give him a call if I was going to give away any players. So they're out there. I'm well aware of it, but, you know, I'll certainly have a cautious approach, and I have good people here with me too, Gary, that are certainly looking out for me.
What's your immediate priority in terms of stocking the Stars to your satisfaction for next season?
Well, it's still becoming a little clearer as to our picture here in Dallas as far as the entire organization. I've been meeting the last couple of days with several different areas within the organization gathering information. You know, the good situation for me is that the team has been left in a real good state. I think that we have a number of players under contract. We have a lot of players in the prime of their career. So Les and Brett have done a terrific job in that regard. So the transition is relatively smooth for me. I spent a lot of years here as a player. I know a lot of the people. So I'm really looking forward to it.
When a player retires, particularly after a 20-year distinguished career like yours, you typically have one of three choices: step away from the game, go into coaching, or go to the executive side. What focused you on the executive side?
Well, it's interesting. I think when you're playing the game, you don't really think about those types of things. Everyone always gave me the advice to excuse me, play as long as you can, and I think that I did that to the age of 40, but I was very fortunate. The game has been so good to me, and a lot of the things I have in life are because of the great game of hockey in the NHL that I was given the opportunity by the Florida Panthers to stay in the game in a management capacity, and for me it was a no-brainer. I think all the guys I've talked to at that time, Al McGinnis, Ronnie Francis, Stevie Y, the game has been so good to all of us that it's really a no-brainer to stay involved. But I really do enjoy the managing aspect of it, trying to put a group of people together that, you know, all go for the common goal.
We're talking to Joe Nieuwendyk, the new general manager for the Dallas Stars. You moved around a little bit as a player, and you've moved around already a little bit as an executive. Is it harder to move around either as a player or an executive, or it's just a pain in the neck no matter how you do it?
Well, a bit of a pain in the neck no matter how you do it, especially in this economy. I'm leaving trails of homes behind me, Gary, and it's not the most pleasant thing, but you never know how the twists and turns of life. But I think things happen for a reason. I feel very comfortable here in Dallas. It's a place that my wife and my family have enjoyed from the time that we spent here. So it feels like a real good fit.
Did you still own a house there when you went back?
No, unfortunately. So we've got some work to do.
If you can remember back 20 years ago, talk about what it's like being a college player at an elite program like Cornell's and what the transition was like for you into the pros.
I'm glad you said an elite program with no bias.
Yes, of course.
Yes, of course. The transition at that time for me was an extremely difficult one. I played my final year of college hockey only playing 22 games, and then the following year I was playing over 100 with the Calgary Flames. So just that swing alone was quite difficult. But You know, I couldn't have went to a better organization. I think the Calgary Flames were kind of one of the leaders in fitness and things like that at the time. So it really taught me at an early age with the veterans that we had, you know, about respect and commitment to your teammates. So my transition was great for me early on.
What do you remember about your years in Ithaca?
Ithaca, well, I'll tell you what, I still go there. That was my first purchase as a pro hockey player was to buy a small house on Cayuga Lake, as I know you're well aware of, and I've been going back there ever since for 22 years now.
This summer included, or are we done with that?
Well, this summer may be difficult, but hopefully we'll sneak away for a few weekends.
So somebody who's hoisted the cup on multiple occasions, what's going through Penguin players' minds tonight as they get ready for the game and Red Wing players?
Well, you know, obviously it's a series now, and the pressure may slightly have shifted back to the Red Wings a little bit, but it's such an incredible feeling. I mean, you never get over that as a player, what those guys are going through, to have that opportunity. It seems when you first start the playoffs and you're 16 wins away, it seems like an eternity because it's over a two-month period. But these guys are getting near the end. You start to think about stuff that you would do with the cup, and you don't want to get too far ahead of yourselves, but there's a lot of fun thoughts that go through your head.
Who is it more important for as a team to win tonight? I mean, obviously, Pittsburgh wants to even up the series, but I assume it's a more devastating loss for Pittsburgh tonight than it would be for Detroit. Or do you think that just completely changes the momentum if Detroit loses tonight?
I think it does. I think it really changes the momentum. I think after the first two games, the way they won rather convincingly, that everyone thought this was going to be a short series. Clearly, if Detroit wins tonight, they're looking pretty good going home. And all the people that said, "I told you so," will probably be smiling. But this Pittsburgh team is pretty resilient. I think they're much better and they're much healthier than they were last year. This is clearly a big game tonight.
Yesterday at the manager's meeting, Tuesday at the manager's meeting, I lose track of time this time of year, there was some discussion about hits to the head. Do you want to give your view as to, you know, the discussion and how you as a former player feel about the discussion that the managers had?
Yeah, I think we went around the table with it, and pretty much the consensus was the same. You know, the hitting is never going to leave the game, and the key is monitoring those repeat offenders and the people that deliberately go for hits to the head. You know, I know we discussed the OHL policy of zero tolerance. You know, I just think we have to be careful that we don't get into a situation like in some a little bit of college hockey and what I witnessed over in the World Championships, where you have a big hit, a big body check, and it results in a penalty. So that may be where that could be heading if we go down that path. But I think the game is great. I think the referees do an incredible job. The only thing at this point, maybe a little more a stiffer penalty for those types of infractions. But I think on the whole, we're doing a pretty good job.
You played college hockey. You played in the Olympics in 2002 and helped win the gold medal. What's your view about, you know, who best participates in the Olympics? Is it good for pros? Is it better for college players and the players who aren't quite yet in the pros?
Well, that's a really interesting debate, and I know we had it sitting there in Pittsburgh the other day. You know, it depends, like we discussed, on the location, the time on TV. Clearly, when it was in Salt Lake and all of North America is watching, it was a tremendous thing, and obviously grows the game of hockey. It's an ongoing debate, and I know the NHL players, they do enjoy that. I'm sure the majority of them enjoy the time off. I'm not so sure it's best for each club, but clearly the players that play and they have that flag on your jersey, it's quite a special moment for those guys as well.
Joe, Billy Jaffe here. Want to ask you one question. Commissioner touched on, obviously, your illustrious playing career, and also you touched on walking into this meeting and thinking, oh, you know, I'm the new guy and everything. I want you to go back. I want you to tell us, if you were more nervous you can remember for your first NHL game as a player or your first NHL general manager's meeting as the GM of the Dallas Stars?
I think I was more nervous for my first NHL game. I have to say, you always wonder if you're ready for the next step and as a player. And I, in some ways, I feel like I am ready for the next step as far as managerial duties. I feel like I have a good feel for the game. I'm very, able to use people around me. I respect everybody's opinion. I just think playing this game over 20 years, you kind of learn a little bit each year about managing. So for me, coming into the NHL was probably a little more scary.
Joe, we thank you for taking time to join us. We wish you and the Stars good luck, and we'll see you at the draft.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks. That was Joe Nieuwendyk, the new general manager of the Dallas Stars. We're going to take a short break. Those of you on hold waiting to talk to us, please hang on, and we'll be back. This is the NHL Hour. You're taking a shower. You can borrow my bathroom. And when I'm asleep, I dream you're moving next week. I crumple the note and said to put in some shoebox. Shoebox lies. It's under my bed. It's never been read. It's in with my school stuff and my mom never cleans that from my first little bit.
This is Rick DiPietro of the New York Islanders, and you're listening to the NHL Hour with Commissioner Gary Bettman on NHL Radio. Now back to Commissioner Bettman.
Welcome back to the NHL Hour. Billy Jaffe, Gary Bettman, coming to you on Sirius XM. This is the NHL Hour. The call-in number is, again, 1-877-645-6696. That's 877-645-6696. I was looking at your expression as the Buffalo Springfield were playing.
I'm going to tell you what I was thinking.
You had a funny look
on
your
face. I'm thinking some pretty good music for bumps. We've heard some different music coming in. Now, Baldy, we might have to talk about some different bumps for the NHL live show.
Well, no, it's personal preference.
I know, I'm kidding. Well, it's good stuff. I'm thinking, nice, different.
But for you, it's retro. You wouldn't have been old enough to remember it when it came out.
I would say I'm not old enough to be when it was in its heyday. Okay. I was old enough when it was around, but you're right. It was not my generation. The hip, we'll call it the hip music, but I like it.
Okay, well,
I was thinking this is different. This is nice.
Let's do it. Let's go to the calls. Barry, Long Island. You're on with Billy and Gary, Sirius XM.
Hi, Mr. Commissioner. Hi, Mr. Jaffe. How are you gentlemen doing today?
We're good. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Jaffe. You do a great job with the Islanders.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to make a quick comment on the headshot issue and a quick comment about the lighthouse issue with the Islanders. First, the headshot issue. The only problem I have with the headshot issue is that the NHL Player Association, from what I understand, had brought it to the NHL's attention, and then obviously they were looking at it. To me, it seems like, it's not my opinion, that a lot of people feel that if there's truly supposed to be a partnership between the NHL Player Association and the NHL, it doesn't seem to be there if the GMs are pretty much just voting on it and that's the end of it.
Actually, that's not the way it works. The managers look at it. The competition committee discusses it. A competition committee will meet in the next few weeks, and ultimately, and the collective bargaining agreement is clear on this, the final authority with respect to the enactment of playing rules is the NHL Board of Governors. But part of the partnership that we have gives them an opportunity to have input, and we think their input's valuable. By the way, we don't disagree with the Players Association that heads need to be protected. Player safety is paramount to all of us. The issue is, what's the best way to do it? The Players Association seems to be advocating a two-minute penalty for any contact with the head, and the managers, again, 200 years of player experience in that room, believe that there is a better way for the game to enforce the protection of heads. And that's why it's being approached the way it is. But we value the players' input, I assure you of that.
Okay, fair enough. That gave me a good insight on that. My other question has to do with the Lighthouse Project. And first of all, I don't want to get too much into the politics that's involved with that, because a lot of people on the outside don't understand all the issues that that take place. But what appears to have been taking place is that the local politician, particularly one Miss Kate Murray, has decided that she's not going to give her opinion one way or the other on the project because she has to eventually vote on it, which is kind of contrary to what a politician would do if they were voting on a bill that was going to go into law. If you were a voter, wouldn't you want to know what your politician thinks about a bill before he's going to vote on it?
Well, I'm not sure that it's a good idea to personalize this as to any particular politician, but if you're a fan of the Islanders, or if you happen to be a resident of Long Island and think the Lighthouse Project is a good, sensible thing, not just for the arena, but as a hub for Nassau County, as an economic engine during a recession, I think you need to let your local politicians know, because in the final analysis, hopefully, there'll be an opportunity for everybody to vote on this, meaning town of Hempstead, Nassau County, so that there will be a final decision as to whether or not this project can go forward. It needs to go forward. It's taken, Lord knows, long enough, too long. Charles Wong, when he said he was sorry he bought the club, it wasn't because he doesn't love the Islanders or hockey. It was because he couldn't believe it would take this many years to not have a new building. And so I think it's important that you let your politicians, your local governmental leaders, know what your feelings are, so that, you know, let's get this thing voted up or down once and for all.
And tomorrow there is a small meeting, albeit a very powerful meeting, as Charles Wong and his partner Scott Reckler and two or three of the local officials, Commissioner Bettman, as you know, are meeting, which is, I take that as you hope, as a positive that they're starting to talk more.
Any progress at this stage is a positive. Let's change gears. People on hold, hang out for a couple of minutes. I apologize. We have a special guest in the studio. The chairman of NBC Sports, Dick Ebersol, managed to just stop by, coincidentally. I think it's because we're about to go to Pittsburgh together. Dick, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. I thought, I walked down here for the first time. I have not been to this store, which is absolutely terrific. And I thought I'd made a mistake with walking into this conversation. I thought I actually was at Fox News that was about a block away, because the conversation was all politics and not hockey. I can do that by going downstairs and listening to Oberman talk in the NBC building.
We talk about anything here. You are well known as being perhaps one of the godfathers of sports television. You just got a Sports Emmy with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Let our listeners know a little bit about the evolution of your career and how you managed to get to the place where your fingerprints are virtually on anything and everything that goes on in sports broadcasting.
Well, I think I ought to quickly start by acknowledging that I'm one of the luckiest human beings in the world. But to try to tell the story as quickly as possible, I'm a foreign exchange student living in Normandy. I'm just about 17 years old. I'm the only American in an all-French school. It's the weekend of the 24-hour of Le Mans car race. I go to the race. There are 800,000 screaming French, all wanting to watch an auto race. I want to find the wide world of sports people, because my dream, not being able to be an athlete, is to be involved in sports media. They hire me as a gopher. Go for coffee, go for ice cream, go for cigarettes. And that began an association. I came back to the States to go to college, and whenever they did an event in New England, they would hire me still as a gopher. And the end of my sophomore year, they said, well, now that you've graduated from Yale, and I didn't tell them I hadn't, they said, we'd like you to come be the man assigned to work with all of our key announcers, McKay, Cosell, Gowdy, all these great names, as their researcher to tell them the stories of the Olympic athletes, which in those days were not only unknown, but almost impossible to figure out a way to know them. People didn't have PR agencies and PR department. So my job was to roam around the world and literally get to know the great amateur athletes, both winter and summer, in preparation for the 68 Winter and Summer Olympics. And that began a career in sports. And fast forward about 6 years later, I was Rune Arledge's assistant and a producer at ABC Sports when I got another phone call from a man who was then running NBC and said, we want to offer you a job which is not what you do now. I was intrigued. I went over, And the offer was come up with a program to replace the weekend repeats of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, which in most of the country aired on Sunday night. On Saturday night, but some aired on Sunday. And I had a year to get a show ready. And luckily, like so many things in this world, I was a producer, but I wasn't a comedy genius. I reached into Canada, and a contemporary of mine who I just started to know, named Lorne Michaels from Toronto, I hired him to be the creative comedy mind behind Saturday Night Live. And in the fall of 75, that debuted. And for the next 14 years, I did entertainment. When one day somebody came and said, we'd like to buy your companies if you would agree to run NBC Sports. And what are you going to say if your whole life had been sports? It was still your hobby, even though you'd been removed 15 years. I sold GE and NBC, all my series that were on the air at the time. And for the last 20 years, I've had this wonderful front seat on almost every major American sport. And it all paid off beautifully when you and five other commissioners of sport surprised me by walking out on stage at the Lifetime Achievement Award. Each of you beautifully attired in a dark suit, and except for the guy from NASCAR was in a brown suit. And each of you said really lovely things, which somebody had managed to pay you to say lovely things for 2 or 3 minutes apiece.
No, nobody paid us. It was all from the heart. What's your philosophy in covering sporting events?
Oh, very key. It's to put the viewer at home at the game, not to give them attitude, not to give them modern science, but to give them the game. And I think what's indicative of what we do best, when we returned to hockey several years ago, the young man who I picked to produce it, Sam Flood, who had an extensive hockey background, he didn't look for special lights for the puck to glow or anything like that. He developed and came to you with the idea of putting the guy in the glass to bring the fan closer to the game. And we like to present the game pretty much unadorned. That's not to say we don't use the best of modern technology when it comes to cameras and to mics, but our idea is to give you the game. And the storytelling we do during the game, particularly for the uninitiated, of which there are plenty of hockey viewers in the United States who are really uninitiated into the players and so forth, we're always trying to tell stories, our announcers are, during the course of the game, particularly during the regular season, so you get to know these people better. When you get to the postseason, particularly this stage, there's enough tension. You don't really have to deal with anybody's bio. I mean, you know, you just say, is number 40 going to continue to shut down number 87? I mean, that's pretty much enough. Then you watch this incredible treat take place in front of your eyes.
They say that broadcast television, particularly sports broadcast television, is in transition because of all of the digital platforms. You probably have had the two converge more than anybody else by the way you cover the Olympics with hundreds of hours of programming on multiple networks and online. How did you come to the vision or the focus that you have in terms of how you're putting out all that content, and do you think it cannibalizes each other?
It doesn't at the Olympics because there's so many people who have separate interests in the Olympics. And traditionally in the United States, whether it was in Rune Arledge's era or these last 20 years in my era, where until the Athens Olympics, you were pretty much subjected to what Rune Arledge or Dick Ebersol wanted you to watch as a viewer, because it was appearing on only one thing. Yet we had never before had the platforms to put all this on. No broadcast company ever had as many cable platforms as we suddenly found ourselves with in 84 after the merger with Universal got us channels like USA and Sci-Fi, and we had, in the year before that, bought Bravo. So we had a lot of them, and the digital world had evolved enough so that by the time of Beijing, we could present 16 days, 2,400 hours of live streaming, plus 1,200 hours of television on six different networks. And that really was more a function of finally having all these platforms. We always had the rights, but we had nowhere to put it because it was basically a one channel, or maybe one channel plus one cable. And the other thing is the Olympics are unique. Most leagues, and I understand why, because you're looking to find the optimum number of revenues for your sport, it's divvied up a lot of ways. I mean, most traditional major sports in the United States, you got a network deal, a cable deal. You have either a, more times than not, you have your own digital rights and you keep them in-house. The Olympics, because it's such a short period of time and they want a lot of money for the rights, you demand all the video rights so you can't be ambushed. I mean, the worst thing in the world would be if we paid, as we do, billions of dollars for the rights to the Olympics and the 100-meter dash was available in the United States when they were overseas at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because no matter who tells it to you, it cannibalizes the audience in a way that advertisers are not happy with it. And they want all, when they pay the kind of money they do, which in the Olympics is $750,000 for 30 seconds of advertising.
We're talking to Dick Ebersole, chairman of NBC Sports.
That's in prime time.
What can our hockey listeners expect from your coverage of the Vancouver Olympics with respect to hockey?
Well, every single game will be seen live, either on the network. For our American viewers, all the games both the American men's and women's team will be seen on, I believe, on the USA Network, except for a couple that will be on NBC on the weekend. This is the first Olympics that we've ever done, Gary, where you are seeing these Olympics take place in a country. I didn't do Calgary, but they're taking place in a country whose love affair with hockey, as you well know, is second to none. And in determining the schedule for these games, the host nation controls the scheduling for purposes of television. And we have a lot of common things with CTV in terms of things we want at certain times. But they want the U.S.-Canada hockey game at 7:30 on a Sunday night, Toronto and Montreal time, which is totally understandable. Well, we have a major figure skating event and a live speed skating event all taking place simultaneously at that point. So in order not to cause anybody in the States to have interrupted coverage on NBC, we'll show that match in its entirety on MSNBC with no commercials. And I'd also like to point out that all of the U.S. men's hockey games and all of the U.S. men's women's games will be presented completely commercial-free during the Olympics.
What do you do? What's your view of the state of hockey as a national broadcast property as we sit here today?
I can't tell you something. I can't feign that I haven't told you this already, but I have real happiness about where it's going, what has really happened this year, which is key for us. The rebirth of hockey in original market cities like Boston and Chicago is just so key to the continued renaissance of hockey in this country, which I date from the end of the labor difficulties. But having Chicago, which I think is, and you know, I'll accept all the mail you folks out there want to send. Chicago's the best sports town in America because when they, as the nation's third largest city, embrace a team, they embrace it in a way that no other city does. And I'm including New York and L.A. in that conversation. And we saw it for years with the NBA during the reign of the Bulls. And so I thought it was really important that Chicago came back this year, and I think Rocky and John McDonough did a great job in Chicago. But equally important, Boston is as well. But the best thing about hockey is you can look at the standings at the end of February, and almost everybody's in it. And as a television executive, you can't want anything more than competitiveness, and that's what the National Hockey League has today.
Well, we thank you for all you do covering us. I think I'm going to wrap us up, and you and I are going to Pittsburgh. This has been the NHL Hour. Coming up next is In the Slot with Mike Ross and Phil Esposito. We'll be back next Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Until then, enjoy tonight's game, and Dick, thanks for stopping by and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks for the free trip.
For more podcasts, check out NHL.com. This is NHL Radio.